again, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Drummer Nation, where I have my esteemed partner in crime, Adam Nussbaum, on board. How are you this week, brother?
If I knew how I was, I'd be a genius, but I'm here and glad to be here. So thanks for having me.
We're glad for that, too. And I must say, I have a living legend as our guest today, and I'm so excited to have never met him before. The one and only Billy Cobham. Hello, Billy Cobham. How are you?
Pleasure.
It's an honor to meet you, sir. Absolute honor.
Yeah, cool.
Well, we like to talk just drums and music eventually, but I want to cover some of your history. You started off very young in was it like a church marching band or something?
Well, before the church, there was the hallowed room of my mother's kitchen, where she said, "Boy, you hit that pot one more time, and you will not get any soup today." And I was hungry, so. Yeah, I took a hint, you know, and then a 1 minute julep, and the next thing you know, we were here, you know. funny how those things happen.
Simple as that. That's
where I started, yeah, at home with mom.
But it was rudimental stuff, right? Eventually.
Well, she wouldn't call it that. Right. I'm putting dents in her pots, with two spoons, you know. Primarily it. I was born into a very interesting family, some of which I just visited a few months ago, who was still around in Colón, in Panama. They remember making drums and timbales, steel pan, that kind of thing, in the shadow of the canal zone. And that's just very little, you know, long distance memories, but I'm 80, and so, oh boy, you know, they're in the hundreds, you know, they've eclipsed 100 years old now, but they're still around, Dennis and them, yeah, they're there.
That's beautiful.
Slow period, slow area of the world, things go by, and they wouldn't even know. It was like light speed is like 30 miles an hour, you know, over there, everything runs slow, you know.
So, well, you moved to New York as a child, though, right?
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, it was just I was there to receive what they call those things, those awards for the life achievement stuff in Panama from the officials there, and ended up going to view pictures of the ship in which my family traveled from Colón, from Panama City to it must have been Colón, yeah. Because we went up on the east side through the Gulf. Yeah, so it's there, and that was called the Cristobal. They just scuttled that boat about no more than 15 years ago. It was around. It was an American transport, military transport ship at the beginning of World War II. And it's got an amazing history because they traveled either to the United States, but carrying people later, but before that, they went with the full a lot of soldiers from Panama, New York, down into over to London, and then continued on down into Australia. So that ship had been around, and they were one of the ships that survived all of the German U-boats all the way down that way. So it's got an interesting history. It's in the library over there. And they made it, and then they turned around and started sending people up to come up and help with migrants, to help with the people that were lost in the war with my family.
Do you remember that passage as a little boy?
Tiny bit. The fact that I mean, from that point on, it's funny how certain negative things stay with you, especially when they have that kind of a thing. But I'm rarely on a boat a ship like that in the rest of my life after that. And because I threw up on the ship, and I remembered at 3.5 years old, I didn't like that feeling. And I think the passage from Panama to New York City was about 2 weeks. And I got over it, but I don't think I ever threw up more than once. I only remember once throwing up, regurgitating, but I remember it, and I will not I when I so I was lucky. I wasn't even invited to play on a jazz boat or anything like that. So I consider myself, man, blessed. I never have had to do that, you know.
You weren't looking to join the Navy, let's just put it that way.
No. Air Force was already bad enough. I was having seasickness at about 30,000 feet, and just trying to get from. And I went, no, that's not going to work. So I won't join them, even though the band was better than the U.S. band, the Army bands. But I think I was thought of in my element with the United States Army band. Everything was on the ground, terra firma. We make mistakes, you get up, and so I ended up in bands with Grover Washington and a whole bunch of cats like that.
But you served in the U.S. Army, right?
I was in Pershing's own, yeah, for a little while, and I was in the field band, and then I was in the United States Army a band at Military Ocean Terminal, Brooklyn, which is for all purposes Flatbush, and I lived about can't be more than 10 or 11 miles up the what would it be would it be it would be
East River.
no it would have been Oyster Bay.
Okay.
That took you out to Rockaway, and I was just up that way, so I got paid to get off the base, $20 a night, and I never turned it down, it was for me. I was getting $122 a month, so $20 a day was not that bad, and I said, yeah, I'll take it.
Billy, can I jump in on something? I read somewhere your father was a piano player.
Yeah, sure.
So he used to, so I assume being the child, you went to gigs. And was that where you were first getting exposure of people playing together and you getting a chance to sit in? I'm always curious who were some of the mentors and the inspirations for somebody, when you're a youngster in those Wonder Bread years.
Remember, oh man, you're from Brooklyn, right?
I was born in New York City, but I spent a lot of time in Brooklyn, but my
Okay.
wife is a Bensonhurst native, not me.
Well, she'd know what I was talking about. What I'm saying, well, to answer that, my father played piano. It was more of a, he was blessed and cursed at the same time. He had this personality that could remember anything. And so in the process, he was born with a photographic memory. I mean, believe it or not, we never had a piano in the house, but my father played piano. His brother, my uncle Edwin, was the chief organist of the Church of Cologne in Panama. And their parents were old school English colonial slaves, not indigenous, slave family, in essence, that's what it was, plantation. And they had these ideas, get a real job, but not just get a real job, you will do this. You were born, and Edwin, the oldest son, you will work with the church. Boom. Okay. What will you do in the church? You will play the organ in the church because they need an organ player. Okay. Not why? No, don't. You will do this. Okay. It's kind of on pain of death. And then without saying that. And then the next son, my father, said, you will be the scientist. You will go to school. You will be the mathematician. You do. And of course, my father would then say, why I get smacked. But there you go. And that carries down into into Billy, who would get the pain down the road. And but that whole scene was very unique because my father kept sneaking around the door in which his older brother was practicing keyboards. And his older brother would then turn around and just show him chords, blah, blah. He would just remember that. And because my family loved popular music, Of course, Spanish music, Latin music, Afro jazz, all of that. They loved jazz and all of this. So I was brought up in this environment where when we moved from Panama, of where they listened to American jazz and all of this and Afro-Cuban music on the CB radio or the whatever they call that thing, to get the shortwave radio, so they could tune in these different stations in Europe, and it was always awesome. Wow, the phenomenal things that a radio could do, you know. And they were curious, curious, curious. Everyone did something musical in the family. It was just natural. It wasn't, wow, this is extraordinary. No one had to be asked. It was a part of your life. Of course you sang. Of course you danced, you know. Of course you went to performances of one nature or another, folkloric, all of this. It just was happened what happened every day. A way to a respite from quote unquote work. You know, whatever work was, which was always something really generally negative for in relationship to the economics of what that was reflected in what you did for what you got. And so in my house, all we heard was either Dizzy Gillespie, Charlie Parker, the Philharmonic Orchestras of the world. The singers, the Billie Holidays, all of these people, they were just, of course they were there, you know. And then it was everything was, of course, you know, you turn on the radio, okay, that's Robin's Nest, turn that up. Robin's Nest is coming from WNEW, New York City, you know. And so when my father got up there, he'd memorized all these tunes in his head. We needed extra money because we were a black family. Nobody was paying it. My folks got $45 a month. It was a lot. So the whole back then, this is 1947, 48, 49. But I mean, of course, the dollar was like so much more like than it is now. And in the United States, it was on the gold standard, not in Panama, which was on the silver standard, where you got 20% of whatever the gold standard was for the same number. So all these things we had to learn, but yet, as in other countries that I've experienced over my years, you find a way to survive because it's either you don't and you die, or you do. Done. Okay, there's only two. So you don't grumble much because the chances of living far outweigh, and the promise of what can happen down the road is obvious. So next thing you know, we're just listening to Sinatra, Basie, oh yeah, top 10, Basie, Ellington, top 10 AM radio? Hello, you know, and this is going on, you know. Song after song, Mel Torme, God, yeah,
Exposure of a
and it's
tradition.
on these big, huge Crosley radios with tubes in them, you know, that look like the old the predecessors of the Wurlitzer record players in commercial in the clubs, you know, or in the
Jukebox.
dining, you know, and it's insane sound, like a mono sound. With all, no speakers, the speakers are inside. You know, the coverages of the front of the radio. It's almost it's two thirds as tall as my dad would be at six. I mean, it's huge, and the sound that's coming out with a 15 or a 16-inch woofer in the bottom. You know, and it's so rich and all of that, and you're hearing all these people, man. All I mean, the bands. So I'm hearing Sonny Payne. I'm hearing Sonny Payne with Basie. I'm hearing so many people. Ellington's players, Louis Belson. Everybody coming through this radio, and they're playing only the top 10 hits per half hour, and it's these people, you know. You can't get around it. You just switch it, just the dial just a tad. This is no FM. They never got that far yet. And all of a sudden, you're in the Latin environment. Tito Puente, Jhelito Rodriguez. And I'm waking up to go to school to that. It's like 5 days a week, walking. But all these things are in my head. And it's not just me. I'm in the Panamanian, who was there? Puerto Rican, Colombian, Brownsville, Bed-Stuy, all in that area was a huge Latin American community.
So it
And
was a very fertile environment,
I had
totally
no
fertile
choice.
environment. Right.
Had no choice.
Now, I
And then
read.
now there's a club across the street. This is Fulton, Robert Fulton Park, Utica Avenue. This is, strangely enough, this is where the A train always stopped. It was a local stop. And so you come up Utica Avenue, and when you come right out of there's a club called Dodgers. Okay. And Dodgers was the Brooklyn Dodgers baseball team. Roy Campanella, Joe Black, Carl Furillo, Pee Wee Reese, and who else? Oh, Gil Hodges. Those cats owned a club there. And what's inside?
Jazz
Oh,
music.
and so here's my dad. Slide in. Never saw those cats, that I knew of. But I mean, what would I know? I mean, we're talking Billy being 5, 6 years old, seven, can't be more. But my dad one time brought me in inside because he had this kind of thing that he did. That's why I bring up the thing about mental rest. He could re keep retain so much. He learned how to play the piano by watching. Okay, then he would sit down and replicate what he saw and heard, without knowing what key it was even in. He only played in one key anyway, and that was F sharp on anything because he didn't know that there were other keys on the piano. He just saw where the hands went, and it was all mostly black keys. So he's playing in F sharp, all the ballads, and all the classics like Sweet Lorraine and My Funny Valentine and all of this. But what he's also doing is that he's trying to find a way to earn an extra buck. So he would go in the Dodgers, where I think, I don't even know if that was the first place it started, but a lot of different clubs because he was in essence, a guy who could retain numbers really well. So he was kind of an economist who remembered what worked and what worked with not. I never knew how all that stuff works. And that word that I'm missing right now it eludes me. But getting back to this, he went into the club. There was a piano behind the bar, up above the. Introduced himself to the when they first started. Said, "Well, it's a beautiful piano you got there." And of course, the bartender says, "Ah, it doesn't work. There's a really out of tune." And he says, "Nobody's going to use it. Oh, they just play when they play when it's fun." And I said, "You mind if I take a look at it? Maybe I can give you a hand if see if." And my father also, as I never knew, but he had perfect pitch. He didn't know, but he would tune the piano with a tuning fork. Knew he had to have that. And he tuned the piano right straight up. And the guy said, and he then he would start to play it just to see how it would work. And this was like free. Just to see. Nobody's in the bars. Bars are dark at 12 in the afternoon or so. It only opens up after 8 o'clock or six. And on Fridays, it's the Eagle Fives on Friday, everybody comes into the bar. Lights up and everything. The guy says, "Wow, that piano hasn't sounded that good in years. And you must charge a lot of money." No. I just live across the street." "You live across the street." And next thing you know, my dad is there, and he's just playing alone the people for tips. On Friday, the eagle's flying, and they're buying, single malts, no matter what. And next thing you know, my daddy is coming home with a lot of the money from the people who got paid that night, and they're singing, doing the forerunner of karaoke, whatever, as drunk as they are. And there we are. We made some money. So now that opens up into Long Island and going out out there and with him once or twice, and because the drummer never showed up, or there wasn't a drummer, but there was a set of drums. And since you like drums, come on, he sat me down. Feet couldn't touch the pedals. It wasn't no chance for me, not at all. So I would have to stand up and try to do whatever I could while not too many people were around. And that was the bug. I was
That's a
sold.
great story. Let me ask you this. I read that in your neighborhood when you got to New York, they're block by block, African Americans, Cubanos, Dominicans, Colombians, Panamanians, and that they were all united not just by drums, but by clave.
Few different ones. And it depends. It depends on how you. It depends on the language. Okay, so Haitians, French, but their clave is different because of, the French is the French. What can I say? Their clave is different. Doesn't matter what. They'll argue about anything. And then you have the Puerto Rican clave, and then the Afro-Cuban clave, with the bata, which is a. It's kind of a backwards ba 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 instead of ba 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 ba. And when the French got a hold of it, or the Carib, there was an Indian tribe in that kind of was the how could I say it, the population of the Caribbean, and it was called the Carib Indians, and these guys sang in a different kind of way, which is but it was into so the didn't matter what, and they all of the feelings in the you could see it in the body how it moved, and you realize that like Aztecas and Incas, they still are around. It's just that their view, the visibility of these community had these communities have diminished in comparison to where they used to be, But in I don't think we'll I don't know if we'll I'll live to see it, but there's a they have in their movements and in the music that they present, they project their history, and the history is very deep. As in, how do you move a 5-ton block of granite to make a pyramid when there was nothing to 3 what thousand years ago? Hello? They don't know exactly, but they do exactly. It resembles however whomever it was that helped them to make that happen. So, and it's again with music and water.
This is wonderful, Billy. Let me ask you, let's get to the drums. You personally, you have a unique grip. Were you pretty much self-taught, like your dad, or
I was
how did you
self-taught.
learn that grip?
Logic. If you do you have a child?
Oh, yes, sir. I have a 41-year-old, no child anymore, but yes.
Yeah, kids are
He's a
always
guitar player.
their parents, man. Trust me.
Yeah, he's still my
Yeah.
baby.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. But when he was like, boop, boop, if you give him anything in his hands, he did like this, right? It was like, it didn't, that's all this is. If when I and I saw my brother do it, and of all people who sort of nudged me on it was, two people. I don't know if you guys ever met, well, Adam, you met Danny over at Manny's, right? Remember Danny? Old, yeah, really old. Okay.
Yeah, he used
Okay.
to work behind the counter with the glasses.
Right. Well, I knew Danny and the family Manny before, and We're sitting with, I just accomplished something for myself. Thank you to Uncle Roy Haynes. He helped me to get into music and art high school in 1958 with a little note that said, put him in, he'll work, or something like, I don't know. But I needed to, Gabriel Kosakoff was the guy that got us in. He was an old trombone player in the army, but he was the head of the one of the main teachers at Music and Art High School in Harlem when I went to
Right.
school. And me and Freddie Lipschitz and let's see who else was there. Jimmy Owens, Larry Willis, boy, we had a whole bunch of us crazy people, Leroy Barton, all of that. We all went to school then. And what happened was it was a way to study. I got a chance to my folks said, you get into that school and you get a drum set. And we couldn't even come close to buying a 5-piece drum set. I got a snare drum with a stand. I got a bass drum, but we had to wait for the pedal because we couldn't afford it. I got a hi-hat stand with no cymbals. And that was kind of it. And I was happier than a pig and shit. I mean, I was like, yeah,
You're
man.
getting to play with good people at school. And let me ask you, was there a specific drum teacher at the school at that time?
We didn't have one.
Okay, so
We
it was
didn't have one.
basically you were
So,
playing everything that you'd learned by watching and
Leo
listening.
Mitchell, let's see, Leo Mitchell, Harry Hall, Larry Hall, Donnie
Leo Mitchell,
Mandeloff.
I remember
Remember?
Leo.
Yeah,
Yes.
all those. We went to school together.
Okay.
All of us. Columbia,
Hello, well.
So all of this was happening, and all we had to do, all we had as teachers, were ourselves to compete against each other in a not even in the front. It was a natural kind of way. You can play bird, it'll show me.
Community.
Yeah. I mean, but it was like, like da -da 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 -da.
Who showed you that initially, Billy? Who showed you the first, huh? Leo Mitchell.
Leo. Now, no, I mean, you got to understand. And Leo was taking kind of sideway lessons with Philly Joe, and over in Minton's. It was all these kind of things that was happening in that community. And yeah, and so he's sliding in and out, sliding in and out, so learning the good things and the bad things. Unfortunately, that's why he's not here. But still, the thing is, we would trade. It was like a virus, We would after school finished at 3. We were still standing in front of the school at 4:30 in the afternoon, and I had to catch a train from 137th Street, Convent Avenue. I had to go to 125th Street, get the A train to take me by then back out home. But by then I'm living in not Brooklyn, I'm living in Ozone Park, which is by Idlewild Airport, not Kennedy Airport. And
Right.
I'm having to do that at least 5 times a week. And if I have a baseball game that I gotta play for music and art, or if I gotta run track, that's Saturday, And it's like, I never even thought about it until one day I went to sleep, as they told me, on a Wednesday, and I woke up on a Friday because my mother said, I thought you were dead. The emergency came, they couldn't wake me up, and my breathing was shallow because I had run out of energy. It took months for me to do that, but I didn't feel like I missed anything. I'd do it again in a blink because there were so many wonderful people there. Janice Ian, who else? I mean, it's just all these people that went to school with me that I go, wow, man, what a history,
It's
But
fascinating because I remember I went to City College for 2 years, which was right up in that hood.
it was right there.
I'd be going, taking the train, 137th Convent Avenue. I remember that area well.
You know
Yes.
that big rock on the hill it was big enough to sit on? I took my art classes there with Richard Tenreich, who was Richard T. He was in my class. And a little tiny guy who was a reasonable bass player named Eddie Gomez sat next to me.
Oh, that guy.
Let's not get into it, okay? But
Reasonable,
anyway.
yeah.
You know what's incredible for me is I got to jump to show you. This was the first record I heard with you on it. And man, when I heard that, it was just like, the intensity of it and, your clarity of precision with such a great groove. It was like, wow. And it was, there were those other bands that had the horns, Chicago, Blood, Sweat, and Tears. But you cats, you were like the high octane version. This was like, this had something else. It had more of like a New York thing. And for me, it was just, it changed the way I heard things and made me appreciate things on another level. And then after that, I was, stuck on you. And I remember hearing, Mahavishnu Orchestra at Westport, Connecticut, Staples High School.
Oh
And
my God.
I remember these things, maybe because, when you're young, I was maybe 14, 13, 14. These things have a deep impression. And it burned in deep. And from that time on, I was like a fan. And then it was like, and then people would say, how did he get that precision? How did he get that articulation and that kind of thing? Now, did that happen when you were working in the band?
Remember, there was a trumpet player by the name of Ray Copeland?
Absolutely. And
No,
Keith was his son.
right. Guess who was my best friend?
Okay.
Keith.
Okay. Wow. Now
And
what?
in that circle was a one of a few composers who worked with Ray, and I got a chance to meet a man, Mr. Richards. His name is Johnny Richards. And because he was writing for Kenton, and Ray was playing from,
He
and
had a
so
band, yeah,
yeah.
Johnny Richards.
Yeah, all that stuff, man. I still got the records here and my LPs, and I could learn. I mean, just watching, because I couldn't understand. Oh man, so many cats came through, and they were playing in five and all of this, but it was subtle, interwoven kind of stuff, and it was the neophonic orchestra, this kind of stuff, and I'm going, what's that? And Keith goes, man, you gotta listen, you just gotta listen, guys. Keith lived on Linden Boulevard when we were living in South Jamaica, and I was living on Inwood Street, and so I was either at his house, because I never saw a full set of I never had a drum set in my house until 1958, and so I was on Keith's drum set, and we were going to go, I thought, to music and art. Ray was already a little bit sick. Next thing I know, Keith isn't going to music and art. I never knew the story until way later, after Keith passed away, because now I have that drum set, a Red Sparkle Gretsch, in my warehouse here in Bern. I took it immediately, and it just represents all the stuff that happened. He ended up being so such a brain. He was in the United States Air Force, secret something or other over there in Iceland. Never played a note while he was there.
Keith.
Keith Copeland. Keith Copeland. Yeah.
Oh, because I remember Keith living in Germany, and I would see him occasionally over there.
Yeah. No, this is way before. When he was with
And
Stevie, way before Stevie Wonder, way before.
wow.
He was in the United States
So,
Air Force. Yeah.
and you've been in Bern for quite a while now.
45 years.
Wow. Did you ever have contact over there with Billy Brooks?
I never spoke to him. I did speak to his sister,
Okay.
who came off rather fascinating. I
Okay.
didn't quite get it. But Billy
Right.
was at the Bern School. George Robert was a great saxophonist whom I was one of my, I mean, he studied with Phil Woods. I love this cat, man. And I was waiting with bated breath to collaborate with him. He wanted me to teach at the Bern Jazz School. And then he said, okay, we're going to do this thing. If you want to do it, I said, man, you don't have to ask me twice. Just let me know where I have to be. Where, I'm coming. Less than, I didn't get a chance to put one leg in my pants before the call came back. They won't accept you. And I never was able to play to teach. And I don't know who decided, but I've been persona non grata in some ways here in Switzerland in the music community for 45 years until 2022. That was the first time I ever played in Marion's. And I've been to Marion's by then 10 times or so, trying to figure out why these cats won't even give me a second look.
That's
And
a
then
club. It's in a hotel in Switzerland, just so people know. And it's a 5-night-a-week gig, right?
Yes, sir. Just
Like
finished it
the old
last week.
days.
Just finished it last week. We had a ball.
I'm sure you did. How great is it to have that luxury that what used to be common?
Adam, man, it's who
Right.
and
And it's a con economic, all this nonsense.
So it's not the economics. I mean, I stayed in Clark Terry's personal suite, with his doctor this and doctor. I was just chuckling to myself, man, God bless you, man. He said, I hope you're doing well up there. It's just, it was, they really, really, the club, there's certain people, the first person I ever met, ran into, and the reason why I went was because I needed to pass on a letter from his nephew to him, was Bobby Rosengarten, who was playing in the Dixieland band in that club. And John Charles was my partner in the United States Army band. I was playing and he was writing arrangements and stuff like that for in the band. And so we were just like really close buddies. And he said, man, just take a note from me. I'm gonna send you something. I can't remember what it was, and I gave it to Bobby because Bobby used to be one of my chief contractors in New York City. I mean, it was like, it was great to see him. He had a heck of a band. Some of the few Dixieland bands that I loved, and one of them was Hips. He had it down, man. And he's all purpose, mallet player, you name it, Bobby played it,
Didn't he do the Dick Cavett show or
Yes,
something?
sir.
Right.
Let me jump in here with some focusing back on the drums a little bit. I mean, you said that you used what amounted to a French timpani grip that seemed
Yes, it did.
logical, seemed very logical to you. Also, you developed the open-handed style. And again, I think if you just take somebody who's never played drums and you give them a pair of sticks and you sit them down at the kit, they're going to hit the hi-hat with the left hand. It
Well, that
seems
wasn't, I mean,
natural.
the big thing was, yeah, they probably would, but that wasn't so much, that was a minor in it was just getting comfortable
Yeah,
and
tell me
it
what led to that style.
sitting properly. When you sit at a drum set, your biggest ally is where you place your butt on a seat and how high you are in relationship to the rest of the drum set. You want to play and be comfortable. Now, that can, for everybody, that's different. If you're going to reach way up there to change the cymbals, there must be a reason, something that there's a reason why you feel that. So that's why you're doing it. Technically speaking, as I found out, you can do that, yes, but for how long can you do that? And what happens if the music content, the concept of the music that you're playing changes from playing that high to projecting? Is it for looks? Which is very, very can be. You want to be different, so you're going to look different. But what about the music? Okay, are you really getting things across? Great example. You could take, starting from the low end, Al Foster, who sat on something that was so close to the ground, but he didn't play that hard, played very light. His objective was to play dynamically within a certain range that was below the decibel level that's normally connected with playing drums in a group. People had to feel them, and that's fine. Then you take in Dugald Chancellor, who sat and the cymbals were almost flat up against the pole of the cymbal stand. So how much sound can you get from that? What is its function in relationship to the drums that he's playing, in relationship to the rhythm patterns that he's using? Why? I mean, he's seeing it that way. God bless him, right? What's he doing today? You know, one of the problems, physical. Body can only do but so much. It has a power. For me, this is Bill Cobham's opinion. You have a parameter, you have a template, you play within that and you feel good about it. Whatever that is to make you feel as if you are special, it's got to start with you. Okay. For me, I was blessed. Not only did I study with Vic Firth, I mean, in terms of concept and talk and philosophy, but I was also with Frederick Daniel Hinger, who was a complete opposite of Vic Firth. He was a Wagnerian timpanist, percussionist. Everything he did, his body was, it was more of an extension of the drumsticks he made that were aluminum based. The drumsticks were aluminum rods that he made himself. He made his timpani. The whole Hinger timpani was something that he made in his own shop. I saw that. I had a set. It was so good. It's made to last. University of Arizona has that set of timpani for me that I had for about 10 years, and then I sold it to them. And that was 19, blah, when I left the United States, 1980. And I had them for 10 years before working with Mahavishnu, my recordings at Atlantic. They're wonderful, but impractical, obviously, for him. I mean, you know, it's like taking around a 50-inch or 60-inch gong in an anvil case? Is it today? I don't think so, man. And giving the guy $20, right? You know, there's stories that used to happen, and he was very happy to take it, you know.
That used to be the thing. Give the guy $20 and he'd get your stuff through, no
Oh
problem.
man, I can tell you some stories. It wasn't only my gong, you know, and the gong got lost. I never saw it again. Yeah, and it was in an orange underscore, orange, red, sun orange with a green, Kelly green. The type, it was like BC on both sides, and then I think so, and they lost it. Eastern Airlines, man. And all we were doing nonstop from New York to Boston, and they lost it.
That's a
Well,
shame.
another story. But anyway, yeah.
Let me ask you about when you sit at the kit, and you've alluded to this, you have such a natural, comfortable demeanor in the way you approach it. I mean, I know drummers. I'm in my late 60s. I know a lot of drummers my age. We're all starting to fall apart. You, if you don't mind me saying, are a few weeks away from turning 80.
Yes.
And you look outstanding, you look fantastic, and I've watched you play recent vintage, and you're still in complete command and control and the finesse and the speed and the power. What do you attribute that to be able to do that at that
One of the
age?
things that I did was that I ordered a seat with a bigger seat bottom so I could get my ass a bit It worked for me, you
You
know.
go. It's all in the throne.
Yeah. Boy, and I never stopped eating spaghetti. But you know, it's like with that in mind, you have a power source. You know what I mean by that? You know where that would be in your body?
Well, I want you to tell us.
But you tell me.
The power source would be your core, I imagine.
Thank
That's
you,
all.
sir. Thank you. Just be sure, I want to make sure I'm on the same page.
All right.
Somebody told me the toe.
Don't think so.
I couldn't
Maybe it
believe
was T.
it in
Maybe
the interview.
Tito Puente.
It's here. It's here where your focus, where you're breathing, where everything comes from.
Yeah,
It's the
you see me
core.
fucking, you focus on your toe, you know. Yeah. But yeah, it's the core. And the main objective is to control that energy. McLaughlin told me once, not at, right in the nick of time, because we were playing at a gig in a club down in the village, and we were opening to Big Maybelle, who is a blues singer, and she really impressed me, because I never thought a woman could be that big. But I mean, I didn't. I just never thought about it. And then to hear that voice, and not the voice yet, what she was singing about. She was singing her life, man. Every note was important. And I got to tell you, we were the opening act. Figure this, relatively darkness. Café Noir was a place named in the village called Café Noir. It was in a couple of movies. And Nat Weiss got us in there. God only knows what worked his magic. And we were just trying to pull John one here, playing some more. So we started to play. And the first note was like extremely loud. But the problem is that we were playing now at that time, and we could physically absorb that back then. Between that show was between 3 and 4 hours long. I only had one break. It was on a tune called Lotus on an Irish Stream. That was the only tune. Everything that was a ballad, if you want to call it that. And so I had to lay out. But I was like, man, there's got to be a better way to do this. And he said, I said, so we were listening to Bartok's Concerto for Orchestra, which was one of the favorites that we all loved to listen to in the band. Literally, it was so much to draw from it on all levels and musical levels and some and just philosophical levels. And I said, you know what? I can't mean to asking you. You're just standing there with this double neck Gibson on, and you're just doing this, man. And you pick, and for me, I mean, back then, I thought, yeah, I'm able to, but I could feel the weight of this instrument. The balance was wonderful, but if you held on to that too long and you were tensing up, it's going to break you down, or your body's going to fall because it's all of the power is. And he would be very loose. And he would just be playing. And he'd be playing. I'd give him 180 to the beat, to a quarter note. It's like silly stuff. And I went, how do you do that? And as I'm playing, I'm watching and observing. How do you do that? Because I'm playing. He said, why don't you just. We had this thing, which the words were tense up, which meant relax. And next thing I knew, he said, just play softer, play, relax, which means you'll probably play softer, but you'll have control over all the patterns you play. And clear, if they can't hear you, tell them to turn you up. And that was it. I said, I know what you're talking about now. And I sat down. And I said, okay, I'm gonna put my feet on the pedals, right pedal, left pedal, hi-hat, bass drum, right, okay, and play from the back of the ball of my feet and my heel, from the heel of my feet, on keep, and the objective is to keep my feet on the pedal in total, never raise them up from the back end. So I'm
Heel
just.
down.
Heel down, peel down, heel down, heel down, heel down, heel down, and play that way. And that's when I found out a lot about me, where my weaknesses were. I couldn't do that. I couldn't even all the speed and all the stuff up top. Now what's happening down here? And then I started to realize that's why I'm getting faster. I have no control in relationship to my hands with my feet. What do I do? Do I, oh man, I can't let any work on not work on, how can I say, shielding everyone from knowing the truth about my weaknesses, or do I fix this stuff? So next thing, from that point forward, I broke down everything and said, okay, I need to get, when we had sound checks, I'd get there early, and Elliot, one of the guys, one of the techs would just give me a bass drum and a hi-hat, no snare drum, and a seat, and I'd sit down off to the side and just try to keep my feet going, just four on the floor, two on the hi-hat, two and four on the hi-hat, one, two, and keep that going. And I found I couldn't do that for a long time, but because my mind wasn't synchronized enough to do that for a long time. And I would just get slow. I said, get to a start at a point where you can do it. Don't worry, it doesn't have, speed comes later. And these were all logical things. That's why, I mean, for me, I felt blessed to be an observer, And then, of course, I'm watching Papa Joe. I mean, I was blessed to be up at the Professional Percussion Center. So I'd see a gazillion people coming through, Max, everybody, just little bits and pieces, Tony Williams, everyone. And I'm just there. Oh, okay, I got it. From press rolls, where the pressure, if it's equal, and if the sticks are to some degree within weight range of each other, now you're ahead of the game. You can balance these things out. Then there's the head, and then you have Al Duffy, who's talking always about tucking heads. So now we learn about tucking heads. All these things, tiny little bits and pieces. I can't blame any young people for not knowing that. Now it's just that it doesn't exist, but if you know, and you know what kind of music you're playing, okay, all of a sudden things start to fall into place. And when I saw Papa Joe he was playing in duet with Teddy Wilson, no bass, okay, on a 26-inch bass drum with a big powder puff beater. And his dancing shoes and brushes, and Teddy's playing stride, man. And they didn't need anybody else. This was on black and white TV back in the day, CBS, and they played some amazing stuff. Just the two of them. And who was there? Wasn't Walter Cronkite? It was the guy before him, the guy that smoked all
Edward
the.
Morrow.
There you go.
Ed Morrow. Ed Morrow.
Edward Murrow. And I got to tell you, man, I went, now I understand. And I mean, so when I finally met Papa Joe, I said, sir, all due respect, all due respect.
Yeah. Let me ask you this. I saw some clips of you with Horace Silver, like a solo on Nutville, and you're playing a right-handed kit with a left-handed grip. I've never seen anybody really do that. So you had a ride cymbal over there, but you were playing traditional
Yeah, because
left-handed.
that was before I realized that I couldn't, that it was, and I was tremendously uncomfortable doing it, even though when I was in drum corps, because I played left-handed when I marched, with St. Catharines and all of that, I would still write for an assist, Bobby Thompson, who was a drum instructor, and we'd write parts. I'd write parts out for everybody else. Because then I was in music and arts, so I was all just writing. I was learning. But I found that I went away from playing the right-hand presentation because it made me focus on going only in one direction, which is from left to right.
Sorry.
But if I went like this, I would play my floor tom more. And I was looking for a way to incorporate the toms into performance, as opposed to, with all due respect, Buddy Rich and Shaughnessy and all those guys, and Louie. Those guys were all over that snare drum all the time in comparison. I would say 85% of the time. And when they play the tom, when I heard them, they were not. It was not with power. It was finesse, or not. It was not with the sense of authority, except for maybe Buddy. And still, he stood out amongst them as a kind of a spike a little bit. But I'm trying to think of who did play a lot more toms. Difficult to say for me because, and I attribute it to the fact that the drums were had tucked heads back then, and so you need canned heat to get the toms to a point where they would speak, and then there was microphones and all of that to go with it. Far, where we are now, man, I'd love to record stuff like that, but again, I'm thinking. Micromanagement wise, a different kind of stick, a different kind of bead, length. Where would I hold the stick? For me, there are about four or five stations on on one drumstick. I mean, it's two of facility. It depends on what I'm playing on. The longer the stick, the tighter the head. The easier the arc is going to come up higher into the middle of the drum. All these kind of things, and I'm seeking because of Vic, not to hold the stick any longer than I have to. Because I mean, even in Vic, he used to say, William, the last time I practiced was maybe 50 years ago, when I joined the Boston Symphony Orchestra. And I'm going, huh? He says, look, I'll show you. And then he would play this amazingly beautiful roll that was just fast enough to create and sustain a tone on the drum. You didn't want to hear no, you wanted to hear and he knew how to do that. And again, the motion was circular. It wasn't up and down. I mean, all these little things, and you go, uh-huh. So now if I apply that to the drum set, or to a set that Louis had me make with three bass drums and three snare drums and where they are and the placement of the drums. Man, we got a whole year, maybe a half a lifetime trying to figure out what comes first, the chicken or the egg, and where to place things, how to sit it, the things that you've placed, how they should sound, how they should be angled, the drums.
Ergonomics as such.
Yes. There you go. There you
There it
go.
is.
Yeah.
Are you naturally left-handed? I'm sure
No.
you've been asked that before.
No.
You're not.
No. I used to in baseball. I used to be switch hitter. So I mean, I play left-handed. I hit right or left, but I throw right.
And now this interest in the toms, is that partly what led you to larger and larger kits?
No, the necessity to provide more sounds, more tonal personalities, attracted me to that concept. With the orchestra, it was about playing the drums, and this is a big umbrella word musically. Okay, then it's harmony, melodically, rhythmically, the phrasing had to be correct.
Just
Seeking
music, everything about the
everything
elements of
musically.
music.
Yes, sir. So, what's beautiful is when you have a combination of mentalities where you're one, okay, the shorthand of music is reading the notes. Okay, good. But it's not primary, it's what you interpret. So, you don't read, I mean, you're reading notes, but you're interpreting what people are playing and how those notes make up a line of information so that you combine your ideas with your colleagues on the bandstand in real time. And that might mean not playing any notes at all. When the time's right, and only you know that, no one can write that. I mean, Tacit is not, doesn't even come close. It's just that kind of situation. So you get to know being exposed to your heaviest teacher, which is yourself, when you make mistakes. And you say, God, man, why'd I do that? Don't ever forget what you did. It may come back in a different way next time. As damn, that was pretty hip what we did back then. But it didn't work before. Fine. You can't water the bridge, baby. Move on.
What do they
You
say?
have to
Mistakes
know.
are opportunities
There you
sometimes.
go. Always. Not just
Right.
sometimes. Okay, you
Right.
didn't do something. That's something. That blah, blah, blah. But
And to
now.
relax, relax and not let it bug you.
Yeah, let it flow. Let it flow. And come on back. So there must have been the reason why I did this. And it's what's a great example? You take Ron Carter. He wrote this thing, which is a map of everything he did at the Plug Nickel, playing on one tune for a week, every show with Miles. Okay, Autumn Leaves was the opening tune, and he played a different bass line on purpose. He was trying to figure out what worked and what didn't work. And then when you tie that into the statement that Miles has made and Herbie has made about the wrong note is only the wrong note by the note that is played after it. Okay, now you put all of that together, you're bam, you've got a personality.
You went right where I was going to go with this, which is to ask you about Miles Davis. How old were you when you worked with Miles?
I hated him. No.
I'm not buying
How old
that.
was I? I was bad at math, man. My father was good at it.
Well, you were young.
But we're talking 1971, 70.
So this was Jack Johnson, or was
That
this
was
before Jack
the
Johnson?
whole, all I was involved with, Adam, was the how can I put it, the Bitches Brew series of recordings,
At
which
that time.
all happened about within a year, year and a half. What was it? Live Evil, Circling the Square, or Circling Around. I don't remember one note I played on any of those records except Jack Johnson. Why? Not because of what I played, but because of what happened to get us to that position where I was playing. And it was so natural. We were at Miles's house the night before, I remember. I saw, I think Svengali might have been there.
That's Gil Evans.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you, Adam.
I'm sorry. Excuse me. I
As
don't
he
know.
was for sure,
Certain things just like,
definitely.
I'm sitting, I'm back home now, so Gil was at Miles's piano, which was built into the couch in the living room. Miles had a piano that was built into the back of his couch. And it was just I came in and we kind of like tapping around. There's McLaughlin, Grossman, Michael Henderson, I think. But I know Mike was on the date. I can't remember. He might have been there too. And I came in and we played a, just tinkle here or there. And we ended up with a composition. I wish I had it. It was a piece of composition paper from that you would normally buy in a notebook for school. It said composition on it. It was black with little dots all over it.
Oh, yeah.
And if you were lucky, you'd get a free box of Good and Plenty with it. Something like that. And you sort of like got all of that stuff together and you. I mean, I'm looking at it and I get this piece of paper, it's lined paper, blue, faded blue lined paper, white. And on that lined paper, may have been 12 lines, and there were eight notes on one per line across the diagonally going down. And said, we're going to play on this scale. But there were no, it was just, those notes could be anything. It didn't say G, it didn't say A, it just said those notes. And if it was going up, an arrow down, and an arrow up. And I went, yeah, okay, I'll leave all of this alone. Miles just said, you got it. It's this thing that you just did on each boogaloo or something like that. Now, because it's now post ESP, so I need that boogaloo. I was okay. And I'm thinking, God, don't let me mess up, And he says, play something. So I played it. He said, I like that. Remember that. Sure enough, man, I forgot everything he told me the night before. But it was after we got in the studio, whoa, boy, it was on the fourth floor of Columbia, H or G, I can't remember.
Pretty
And
straight.
yeah, and we just, no, it wasn't 30th Street, it was 53rd.
Okay.
You know, it's where Arthur Godfrey was filming, was doing his show either downstairs or upstairs from us. Yeah. And so you just heard all of this, and he said, "That motherfucker, Arthur Godfrey, with his ukulele." Anyway, so the next thing you know, we play. We're just waiting for him. We got levels. Tonkel did what he did. Teo's Teo. Miles says, "Talking ill, don't play in between sets." Me, I'm cool. I'm just sitting there. But because John is John, McLaughlin, he started thumping away a little bit, you know, just thinking about which turned out to be but then it was just a shuffle. It was a did bit because he just couldn't stay still. All of a sudden, Michael Henderson just started playing. It was very soft, you know, and it felt so good. And he was sitting down. And my hand, I don't know what happened. My hand started moving. And the next thing I stopped playing, just this light, you know, and it's starting to get like pretty intense because now John is solo. And the next thing I know, Miles comes in, "I told you not to play in between sets." Everybody's up. Henderson just took it personal. "Man, this MF, he gonna tell me this way. He ain't gonna show me that." Now, I'm going, "Oh God, man, I don't need to be in the middle of this. Let me just quiet and just bang, you know, and see where it goes." Next thing you know, John is laughing and he starts again. He's just, and Michael picks it up and did, and now it's like roaring, man. Next, Miles runs outside and says, "Red button," you know, and you just saw the mouth because now we're. Couldn't hear him talk. We started recording. We started doo 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 and John's ba 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 doo. Next thing you know, we've got this thing happening. Red light, the door. In through the door walks Herbie with a bag of groceries, and an LP from his first LP on Warner Brothers called Fat Albert Rotunda, just been released. He gives it to Miles. Miles is saying, "Play." And Herbie said, "I'm triple parked." As in New York, in Harlem, it was, well, I'm so used to it. Yeah, couldn't be double parked, you know. It was triple parked on 53rd Street between Park Avenue and Lexington. There's no way. There ain't no truck going down there. And you know, it's not angled in. It's just one, two, three on both sides of the streets. And I'm going, triple punt. I'm watching all of this going down. I'm saying to myself, I am a bug on the wall checking this out. All I need to do is just keep time. I don't have anything. And finally he gets Herbie to put the bag down. He took the record and said, "Play." And Herbie starts to play then I didn't realize until I heard later, that Farfisa organ had not been played in 4 or 5 years. It was just dusty. So when he played on the organ, they plugged it in and it blew, it didn't blow up. It just blew all of the dust out of the thing. It was all this gray that went into the air in the studio. And he started playing pop, pop, pop. So when you hear this kind of cryptic patterns, he's trying to understand which notes work and which don't. And then the next thing you know, his two forearms just go down. And I'm watching this like big eyes, man, going, Oh, I can't believe, no one would ever believe me, but I saw this and it was, I said, this is something for the annals of time. I mean, because what came out was off the hook, man. And then that couldn't have been, maybe that record date started around 10. Miles said, we got it. I don't even remember what we were supposed, oh, we were going to do music for Jack Johnson. And that's the music we did for Jack, but it had nothing to do with what happened in his house. Done.
Fresh,
I think,
fresh.
part of Miles's, brilliance was bringing people together and just let's see what happens.
But Adam, can you imagine walking into, I
You had
mean,
Keo there who also knew how to, and
so
he
that's why you've
was
got Silent Way on some of this stuff and all of that, and it just worked.
Yeah, it's it's just fascinating sometimes what happens, the magic of the moments.
That's the only record I actually really felt like I made a contribution on, and it was so mystical in a way. All of this stuff was happening around me. I felt more amazed by just walking into the middle of a community of souls that were so beyond anything I could ever conceive of. And when you walk into a place like this, into that state, into a studio like this, and you see as the door opens, the first cat on the side, on the, as you walk through the door, is Chick on a Fender Rhodes, completely gutted, and he's got wires coming out of it every place else. He's in little tiny glasses. Next to him, beating, I forget the name of that old, that was another electric piano. Was Chick, was Keith Jarrett, and
Was
he's
it
one of the
a
few.
Wurlitzer? Was it a Wurlitzer?
It might have been a Wurlitzer or something else like that. I mean, he's beating the Wurlitzer with the heel of his shoe, and he's screaming at it because it so that those two, and then next to them is Joe Salvini, who is going like this. It's like that's just three, and then the fourth cat, Larry Young on organ, and Larry's wearing a purple muumuu with a big Panama hat, and he looks like the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. I mean, it was just like, come on, this, I don't want to play, I just want to watch, you know? And that was just the core of pianists. And then there's Illyria Lima percussion running around like he, with a berimbau, screaming, I don't know
Was
about
it
what.
Airto? Was Airto there?
Ierto was there as well, but
And Don
Ierto,
Elias?
no, Don wasn't there.
Okay.
But Elroy Choudhury was there. Ierto was there. He came in with a huge suitcase full of anything. I thought the kitchen sink was going to fall through there, fall out at any point in time, and everything else that was related of sounds. And so that was just, he was in a thing by himself. But they wouldn't, Illyria wouldn't stay inside any box, any box. So that he just ran with no shoes on, his pants legs are rolled up, and he's running around screaming with a beer in mouth. And that was some out stuff, man. And with all of that happening, what I found to be really special, because John, of course, was there, but Grossman, it's just leaning against whatever it was, like a baffle or something, and it's like he's about to sleep, but his saxophone's ready to go, and I'm going, how can you sleep in the middle of that? Ron Carter was there, Harvey Brooks was there, and I think one more drummer. I did not speak to him. Didn't it was, if it was Lenny, but I didn't, or Jack, I didn't know. But I don't think I was the only person there at that time.
Billy, these stories are fabulous. Adam has to bug out at 12:30. Can we do
Dr.
a can we do a part two? It's can we do a part two at some point? I mean, this is wonderful, but I've got a lot still to ask you about.
yeah.
Okay.
I'm home in Panama between May 5, Because now, again, not possible. But from May 5 until, or May 6 would be better for me, until June 10th,
Okay,
I'm
we'll work
around.
that out.
And you guys are in at Eastern Standard Time, right?
Yes, sir, yeah.
Yeah.
We'll be all in the same place in Eastern Standard Time then.
Okay.
Right
Well,
now, I'm in Germany.
I'll
I
get this.
wish I could stay. I have a family obligation that, that I have to.
It's not a problem, man. That's it. These are just
Man, I
nice to
love
get used
hearing
to.
these stories, and I'm so grateful that at least the technology has enabled us to come together.
Sure,
And
sure.
because something that it's always great to hear backstories, because when we see somebody who plays so wonderfully and has been such an inspiration, you see what they do. You can maybe figure out how, but this gives us an insight as to why these things have occurred. And I feel that this is very necessary, especially because we are living in a different time than things used to be. And there's certain things that can't be replicated. Oral history is something which is wonderful. And I'm just so glad that you're here and you're still out here as a vital force.
I mean,
An
why not?
inspiration to me, man. Absolutely.
Great,
Such an
great.
inspiration.
You know what? Because
To
I
so
wanted to ask
many.
you, but next time around, another place that I never had, I think I walked into that place once. It used to be a jazz club on Park Avenue, down in South Park Avenue. I really wanted to play that place. I was wondering how it sounded in there because I think you might have played there. It was a jazz club. Randy Brecker's ex-wife used to play there a lot.
Ileana.
Elias. But it was a cool club, and it was really well taken care of. Really nice place.
Down on Park Avenue.
It was like not on Park Avenue. It was on all. It was in between Park Avenue and Lexington, maybe, or Park and Madison. South Park Avenue down to.
I'll ask her. I got a gig with her at the Kennedy Center on May 10th, so
Yeah, she'll know.
looking
She'll know.
forward to that. Yeah.
I mean,
All right,
wow.
gentlemen, we'll hook up for part two, and I'll get this out probably next week and pretty soon, and I'll send you all the links. I can't thank you enough, Billy. I'm honored that you would speak with us today.
Not at all. Not at all. Fun for me. Fun for
Oh,
me. No
good,
problem.
good.
Hey, you guys, be well. Stay
All
safe.
right. Thank
Huh?
you, man. Thank you, cats. Stay
Okay.
well.